Well, you're going to get a sermonette this morning. That's a short sermon. I may just cut it off at some point and pick it up next week, so we'll see how we go, because we still want to do communion together as well. Isn't it wonderful, though, to hear how not only how people began a life-changing relationship with Jesus, but how they continue to grow in that relationship? And we are coming back to a series that began in fall, Keep Growing, Lessons from 1 Corinthians. You know, Paul's goal, and he says it often in his letters, was to see Christ's character formed in them, in us. And in chapter 7 of Paul's letter to the Corinthians, I invite you to turn to that, we pick up on what has already been a rather provocative conversation going on between them, yes, over mail. And in chapter 7, verse 1, Paul begins responding finally to the matters that he says that you wrote about. But his first six chapters were spent talking to them about things that they chose not to put in their letter to him. You know, they didn't talk about the deep divisions that were splitting their church. They didn't talk about the public case of incest that was even, you know, out in public in the community. They didn't talk about members taking one another to court. And both of those last cases, by the way, they had made the local public news. We know by this point in the letter, any attempt to minimize or to hide the really hot topics that they were dealing with, it didn't work. Paul found out anyway through Chloe's household, he says, has informed me. So now, nearly a third of the way into the letter, Paul finally gets to the items and issues that they wrote to him about, that they had brought up. So let's read the first 16 verses of chapter 7. Now for the matters you wrote about. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so Satan will not tempt you because you lack self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all of you were as I am. But each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. That is, the Lord has spoken about this. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest, I say this, I, not the Lord. That is, I don't have a direct word from the Lord on it, but I'm extrapolating. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? We will pause there. Well, depending on your translation, the first topic or issue that Paul deals with is, what about a marriage? Avoiding women? Celibacy? Which is it? If you could show the next slide. Some translations say it is, you know, you asked, is it better not to marry, or a man does well not to marry. Others, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And others, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. So what really is the meaning of verse 1b? Whose statement is it? Is that Paul's statement, or is it the Corinthian statement that he's quoting? And what qualifications or clarifications does Paul make in the verses that follow? Well, option one, kind of was a traditional view for quite a while, is that the statement is a statement of Paul's position. That is, it is better not to get married. And old versions of the New International Version translated it that way. And in that view, if you can't stay single and celibate, which is the highest calling, then get married. And in verse 7, then, in that view, Paul would reinforce this ideal of single and celibate. And his concession would be that those who lack self-control, a.k.a. the gift of celibacy, should get married. And then verses 8 and 9 would just repeat this basically all over again. Now, the challenge with this option is it's actually a faulty translation. And the theology of that doesn't really fit with what Paul says even in this chapter and definitely in the other letters. So a second option has been, well, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. You know, well, the older translations had that, but that we know from ancient literature, Greek literature, is a euphemism, always a euphemism. That is another way of saying, you know, sexual relations. We would say, you know, don't get into bed. Well, what we mean is have sex, right? It's a euphemism. And over six centuries, it always means that. It never means don't get married. So that leads then to a third option, which is the third one by the NIV and ESV. Paul is quoting their statement, with which he is in some agreement. But he does not agree with how they are using, or rather misusing it in some ways. For example, it is clear in verses 2 to 5 that we read that some were saying it is good not to have sexual relations. And they were applying it not to their single life, but to their married life. Huh. Now, why would married people consider having a sexless marriage? Well, then there were some who believed that sexual abstinence was widely viewed, especially by philosophers, as a means to personal wholeness and religious power. That if you didn't use your sexual, you know, drain your sexual power in some way, you could use that for greater philosophical pursuits. And actually, it was Gandhi. I remembered the great Mahatma Gandhi. He had been married when he was 13 years old and had, I think, 3 or 4 children. And then at the age of 38, still happily married, took a vow of chastity. And he saw it as essential for selfless service, renouncing marital sex to transform physical urges into spiritual strength. He said, "It is the duty of every thoughtful Indian not to marry. In case he is helpless in regard to marriage, he should abstain from sexual intercourse with his wife." So, in a different cultural context, this is still a live issue. Now, we need to keep in mind that in chapter 6, Paul spoke to the anything-goes crowd. That is, who practice sex with no limits with anyone. Now he addresses what we would call the ascetics, that is the all-limits people, people who viewed the body and sex as evil, including sex within marriage. Now, there have been some misguided views in church history based in part on misinterpretations of verse 1. That is, this is Paul's statement versus the Corinthian statement. You see, quotation marks were never used in the original in Greek at the time. So you were always having to interpret that to guess what, you know, who said what in that sense. But then the Catholic Church especially elevated celibacy and singleness above, you know, as the highest calling, which is, I think, misguided. Now, Paul's words in verses 2 to 5 clearly qualify and correct the attitudes and actions of some of those Corinthians. And so it makes the most sense to see Paul's concession not as, you know, if you can't have the highest calling of singleness and celibacy, then, you know, concession, you can get married. No, it's rather his concession is pointing back to verse 5. That is, it's okay to pause your marital physical intimacy if you mutually agree to it for a time of dedicated prayer. But that is, you know, it's like he really reduces the concession that he makes. This and not marriage is Paul's concession. Paul honors both marriage and singleness equally. Compared to Judaism, where he grew up, which elevated marriage. And in the culture of the time, Stoicism and later Catholicism, as I mentioned, elevated celibacy, which is contrary to contemporary trends that disparage marriage and spurn celibacy. We follow a Messiah who died as a 33-year-old single, celibate Jewish male in a culture where marriage and having children were the norm. You see, Jesus elevated singleness to equal stature and embodied God-honoring singleness for the sake of God's mission, as Paul then did, and he commends to others as a real, viable, and often good option for Christians. This is why in verse 7, Paul refers to his own status, unmarried. And in verse 8, he will put himself in the widowed crowd. So he probably had been married and then widowed and chose not to remarry. And he's saying that's equally honorable, remaining single. Even preferable, he says, if you have been given the gift from God, that of celibacy, and a calling like Paul, which was what? Itinerant ministry, traveling all over. How well would that work with a family? Either you leave the family behind, you know? So for him, it's like, God, thank you for the gift, because this is the mission that you have called me to. And that's why he really presents that as a totally viable option. But for the already married, their calling is clear. God's call for you is to maintain a healthy, mutual, reciprocal, intimate marital relationship. I'm going to skip a little bit here. I wanted to say about singleness. Singleness should not equal aloneness. Mm-mm. Paul never traveled or served alone in ministry. All of his letters say Paul, and he's writing with somebody else. He's always working with somebody else. Jesus sent out his disciples never one by one, always at least two by two. We should be making space in our lives, our personal and corporate gatherings, for singles, the not yet married, the never married, the no longer married. I could talk about what about widows, widowers, and widows. I do believe that is what the translation should be, not the unmarried and the widows. It's just that they didn't have a common Greek word for men who had lost their spouse. I'll try to cover some of that next week. Paul's counsel is to... but I didn't want to get this. Okay, Paul's counsel to the formerly married is accompanied with a qualification, urging them to seek remarriage if they cannot control themselves. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now, that doesn't sound like the best reason for getting remarried. And it's not intended to be the best reason for getting remarried. Paul is here speaking, I believe, to those formerly married, now single people who are not practicing sexual self-control. They're probably the ones in chapter 6 who are going to prostitutes instead. And Paul is saying, no, that is not an option for believers. Okay? So he is likely here offering marriage as the proper alternative for them. And he doesn't say it, but what people all need, far more than sexual intimacy, is relational intimacy. Spiritual friendships, genuine fellowship, That is really what our hearts crave. And Paul will go on in verses 10 to 11. You know, what about marriages that break down? He affirms in verse 10 that marriage is for life between a man and a woman. But in verse 11, he acknowledges that some marriages break down. We have heard that this morning, right? Paul here assumes a situation in which reconciliation is still possible. And he doesn't say explicitly what a person should do when that is no longer possible. Are there any exceptions? And we know from Jesus, Jesus talked about adultery as breaking down a relationship. Paul will identify in the verses that follow abandonment. That is an unbelieving spouse that chooses to leave. Okay? And many would also include abuse. And we actually had, that not just physical, but also emotional, spiritual. And that should be added to the list. And you should know that our congregation, it's quite a few years ago now, but we had an intense discussion and decision about this. We had an abuse support group with women, not only some within our own church, but in our own community. And it was a very live issue. What do we believe about divorce? This relationship has broken down in abuse. And so we came to a decision in line with our denomination, our National Faith and Life, that is our spiritual oversight team. Basically, they have a resource called When Marriages Fail, and just one quote from that. Nowhere do Christ or his apostles suggest that divorce and remarriage are unforgivable. Not. By his offer of forgiveness for sin, Christ made it possible for people who have failed to have a fresh start. You've heard this lived out this morning in a testimony that was shared. And you would do much better to go for more details, to ask people who have walked this journey and have learned what Christ has taught them in and through that, to share with you and to pray for you if you are going through a challenging situation. I'm going to skip right to the applications. Four, briefly. The first is to pursue Jesus-shaped relationships. Jesus should... It's not just, Jesus changed my life, turning me from hating God to loving God, but that way of Jesus, his values ought to continually be get worked into our lives until they become embodied. And let the teaching and values of Jesus transform our closest relationships. Secondly, we need to seek the help of God's Spirit to change and to equip us. Again, we have heard about that this morning. Right? And thirdly, we need to reach out to fellow believers. Maybe those that we see that are needing help, or maybe we are the ones, and we need to reach out to those who maybe can help. Especially people who have gone through, when we discover someone's gone through a similar situation in their life that we are going through now, I always say, you're going to have somebody, if you connect with that person, you're going to have somebody who prays for you better than anyone. And they may have something to share with you of what God has taught them in their life. And finally, be the family of God. Make room. We should be making room in our lives and our gatherings for those who are detached, maybe distant or disconnected from their families for whatever reasons there may be. It's one of the reasons we talked about we want to have more church potlucks this coming year. We're going to have one right at the end of January. If you want to sign up already, they've already got a sign-up sheet there. But it is a way when we eat together. There's another opportunity. When we serve together, we're going to pack up Christmas today after the service. If you want to get to know some other people, you can join us. And you can help. It'll probably go fairly fast that way. But serving together and learning together, all ways that we can be the family of God. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we can ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work in us, To him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus through all generations, forever and ever. Amen.